Canucks Central Wednesday. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. We are a presentation of your local Grip Auto and Tire location. Friendly service and expert advice are waiting for you at gripauto.ca today. Lots to come on the program. Kevin Woodley, the goalie guru, going to join us later this hour. In the second hour, we'll talk to Danny Webster about the Vegas Golden Knights signing up Bruce Cassidy as their new head coach. We've talked a lot about which players may go, Sat, which players may stay, what options the Canucks have with the big contracts they need to dole out for certain players. Yesterday, our discussion about JT Miller or Bo Horvat. Should there be more of a discussion around Bo Horvat's future in Vancouver? Kind of popped off a little bit. You can find it on the podcast. Subscribe, leave a review. We do appreciate it. But what about the Canucks' strategy in free agency? Mm-hmm. Who might they bring in, or who might they be targeting to bring in as additions to this roster?
Well, I did think it was interesting hearing what Rick Dollywall had to say today about some players the Canucks might be looking at in free agency, and a guy like Zach Sanford, his name came up. You're talking about a guy who's, you know, bigger and more physical and stuff like that, and there are certain other guys that kind of came up too. So I know people have mentioned and wondered about players like Nick Paul and stuff like that too. And my biggest question is, yeah, I can see them being interested in players like that and other guys, you know, but they're not, I don't think, going to be very active on day one.
Right.
Like, for instance, a guy like Nick Paul, I can see how it lines up and how he's a guy that would make a lot of sense. And he fits a lot of the character things we talked about. We also fits kind of the toughness thing we talked about, the mm-hmm. speed and all those things. The question is, how much do you want to pay that player coming off a very impressive cup run? Is he a guy that you want to dole out a lot of money to? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they do. So how does that align? What they're going to look to do, I think, especially when it comes in free agency, and I believe Rutherford himself kind of hinted at this, we'll look at some guys that are younger, see what we can do early on. But if somebody's a bit older, we'll see how it plays out a few days, a week after free agency. Maybe then somebody's of value on a cheap, you know, short-term deal that can help us out. I think it's very much bargain bin shopping and very strategically looking at free agency. Like, I'm not expecting them to be outbidding teams for a guy like Nick Paul, for instance.
Yeah, that's everything Jim Rutherford and Patrick Ovechkin have talked about is, you know, cap flexibility, wanting to maintain that, wanting to maintain competitiveness with this roster, but also, you know, being smart about it, thinking about the short and long-term health of the Vancouver Canucks. And my sense of the situation and how they will go about their business in free agency, obviously they have lists, they have players that they would like to target, but I don't get the sense that this organization is going to get stuck on one player or two players and say, circle that player's name on the whiteboard and be like, we have to have that guy. One, I don't think they feel they're in a situation that that is necessary, right? We're not close enough to say there's one player on our list that we think really puts us over the top and everything that player provides. I don't believe that this management group thinks they're at that stage. And two, it's the cap flexibility thing. They don't want to be in a situation where they are overpaying for something at or near the bottom of their lineup. They are very much looking for value situations when they go to make additions this summer.
And when I hear guys like Zach Sanford and Kevin Rooney, who Rick mentioned, those are guys I could see them signing on day one because it's not going to cost a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about guys that are very much specifically role players. And, you know, I know Rooney played about 15 games in the playoffs, but only a couple of points. Like, very much a fourth line type of guy, but he's a centerman, has a bit of size, can do a lot of different things for you. And we talked about the Canucks needing more guys like that. Is he maybe a better version of a Juho Lamico, for instance?
Yeah. But free agency, Sat, you know, nobody expected Tucker Pullman to cost four years at $2.5 million. Nobody expected Jay Beagle to cost, or Antoine Roussel, to cost $3 million.
100%. And if it gets into those ranges, I don't see these guys signing them. But like Kevin Rooney's 29 years old. What is he going to sign for? Yeah. Maybe $1 million?
Yeah.
I mean, this guy's coming off a 12-point season. You know, Zach Sanford ended up in Winnipeg last year. I mean, didn't have a lot of points. He's 27 years old. His career high is 30 points in 58 games back in 2019-2020, coming off, you know, a 21-point season in 80 games this past year.
Yeah.
What is he signing for? 800K? A million, maybe? Those guys would make sense. Kind of young, have some size. I can see those guys getting signed early, but anything bigger than that, I think it's, can it align value-wise in a few days? Because I don't think they're going to look at it and say, hey, this guy's 30, no chance we sign him. And it could even be a good player that wants a two-year deal. Because all of a sudden, if you look at it and say, we have $4 million in extra cap space, we want to sign somebody to help us out in our top six, for instance, after making some trades. And it's like, okay, well, we're not seeing a line really in free agency, and this guy's a bit older. Let's just use somebody for an example. So let's just say Riley Smith, just as an example. And he would sign for $4 million on a two-year deal. That might make sense for you all of a sudden, because it's a two-year deal. He can help you out. You know, at some point, a player, no matter his age, would make sense for you if the number is right. Could that happen a week after free agency, for instance? Now, I know Riley Smith's likely to stay with Vegas and all that sort of stuff, but just as an example, something like that could happen, but I don't see them being there first on day one or day two of free agency, trying to outbid teams for some free agents.
Well, the Toffoli contract, which seems like a bargain now, you know, 4 years at four and a quarter, that was something, a very interesting situation where Montreal was able to sign a really solid player at a reasonable number to add to their group. Now, again, I don't think that's a term that the Canucks would be totally interested in 4 years, but very rarely do good deals happen on the first day of free agency.
Yeah.
Very rarely. You know, we talked to Shayna Goldman yesterday, and we're talking about Nick Paul, and everybody's in love with Nick Paul right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been a great fit for the Tampa Bay Lightning, plays in so many different situations, has stepped up with Braden Point out of the lineup, has been a big face-off guy for them, is versatile, can play the wing, can play through the middle, does a lot of those, you know, hockey man type things that people really love and tend to overpay for.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Paul seems like a great player right now, but if he's getting, you know, 5 years at $4 million, like, is that?
Or, yeah. I mean, I would.
Is that something you're going to be comfortable with? No, all of a sudden, right. Nick Paul's the guy that you're like, oh, that guy's getting paid too much money.
No, I don't see him getting $4 million. And hey, maybe I'm proven wrong on that. What I can see him getting, though, is a Roussel contract from someone.
Right.
$3 million per year, 4 years. Is that something you would do? Now, he's a bit younger than those guys. Those guys were in their 30s when the Canucks signed them, whereas where Nick Paul is now, who's 27 years old.
Yeah.
So even if you sign him to a 4 year deal, he's 31 at that point. But if there is a big, you know, market for him, does somebody kick in a fifth year?
Mm-hmm.
Does he get a Colton Sissons type of contract, which is close to $3 million and six, like 2.75 or something over 6 years? That becomes a bit tough. And we've seen those contracts be handed out. Is he somebody's Brandon Tanev?
Mm.
And hey, who signed Brandon Tanev?
Jim Rutherford.
So, I mean, you know, could that happen? Is that somebody they identify potentially and say, hey, we need that type of player here? And so that's what we want. And if that's the case, then maybe they go out and do it. But it just doesn't align with where they're at. At least Tanev made sense for the team where Pittsburgh was because they're trying to win. They're really aggressive. They felt like if we add this guy to what we have in our bottom six, it just helps us have a better chance of winning a Stanley Cup. I'm not sure that type of investment in a 27-year-old role player is what this team needs right now.
There's a reason the Canucks are so far in on the Kuzmenko talks.
Yeah.
It's because the risk is worth the reward.
It's a one-year deal.
Maybe it doesn't work out, but it's costing you $1 million for 1 year.
Yeah, and honestly, to some degree, the value could be somewhat limited depending on what happens. Because even if he has a good year, he may be priced out, especially if he wants the biggest paycheck. You're not really going to trade him, most likely. He's going to be here for a year. So it could just be a one-year thing. But at the price point, why not? Who cares?
Yeah, at the price point, it is worth it. Those are the types of things that I think the Canucks are interested in. Again, the sense I get is they're not going to fall in love with one or two players and say, we absolutely have to have that guy and make sure that they get that deal done on the first day of free agency. I may be wrong, but I think that is one difference from this management team compared to the last one, who quite obviously got themselves into quite a bit of trouble on the first day of unrestricted free agency and had a lot of mistakes on their mark because of it. But, you know, you look at what they did later in the offseason to add to the Abbotsford Canucks and some of, you know, those players to increase some of the depth within the organization. You know, some of those, like, nobody had any problems with those deals, the Nick Patans and the DiGiuseppes and Dowling coming in and playing some good minutes too. Those types of deals, there's so little risk in them that when you wait in free agency, that's where some of the best deals end up happening. Heck, one of the best signings Jim Benning even made was Thomas Vanek.
Yeah, one-year deal.
Right? There's no such thing as a bad one-year deal, as I always say. And I think that's probably the mantra. That's the sense, at least, that I get this management team is going forward with. And it's, quite frankly, what Jim Rutherford has said publicly. He said it numerous times. If there's value on a veteran free agent later on in the summer, then we'll look at that. We'll look at things like that. But otherwise, we're not going in on those types of players.
No, and what they should be looking to do is finding the next Nick Paul types and not going and signing Nick Paul, who's 27, to a big free agent contract. And that's ultimately going to be what they're going to be looking to do, I think, is finding those types of players before they become those players. And, hey, they signed a couple of free agents that were unsigned by the teams that were drafted recently. They've signed Archdeep Baines as well, and we'll see what they do in draft. But clearly, that's going to have to be the avenue they take, the longer-term kind of view in finding those types of players.
It's Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. So that's sort of the strategy that we might see the Canucks take in free agency. And we've heard Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin talk about wanting more sandpaper. We've heard about them talking about more team speed. All of these things are out there in the open as things the Canucks management group wants to achieve. Now, if we look at Tampa Bay and Colorado, Stanley Cup final beginning this evening, you'll hear it on Sportsnet 650. Are there certain traits about the two Cup finalists that you would like to see more of on the Canucks?
Man, it's a great question because it's the easy answer is to say there's so many things you can learn from them.
Yes.
But it's also obvious to say.
Yeah.
There's so many things you can. But what is something that you can specifically, tangibly take from them and try to apply? That to me is the question, right? Because, yeah, obviously you want to draft well. Mm-hmm. Obviously you want to develop players well. You want to have speed and all that sort of stuff. Is it as simple as having a really clearly defined identity? Is that maybe the most basic root thing we can look at?
In theory, that does help because, okay, we have our identity. We want to be aggressive on the forecheck. We want to be strong in our own end. And the old cliche of tough to play against. Those are all things that make a ton of sense. When you hear those words, maybe you roll your eyes at them because they can be a little bit vague and it's like, well, every team wants some of those things.
Yes.
But some teams accomplish it better than others. You know, we know what the obvious is. You've got to have a lot of high-end talent on your team to end up as a Cup finalist.
Yeah.
Both of these two teams have that. But how have they built the rest of their rosters? And you could even apply this to the Canucks because, what do we say? They are a bit top-heavy. They've got some really quality core players in place. Franchise players, if you will, with Demko, Hughes, and Pettersson. But how do you continue to build beyond that and finding better players to fill out your second, third, and fourth lines? And I think that's the interesting part about that is Tampa Bay and Colorado have done that very differently.
Mm-hmm.
Tampa Bay has hit on some long shot draft picks. When you think of Cirelli, you think of Braden Point. Colorado has hit on their high-end draft picks going back even more than 10 years ago with Gabriel Landeskog, but they haven't hit on any second, third, fourth-round draft picks. Literally, like, go through their draft history. They haven't hit on any of those guys, really.
Yeah.
Since, like, Ryan O'Reilly and Tyson Barrie. Many, many years ago, those guys were drafted. But they've hit big on trades and smart free agent signings. From a, you know, identifying players to really bring out the most of your roster. Colorado's done a great job of that in trade and free agency, but they've done it with the mindset of we need to be fast through our entire lineup. We want to push the pace. We want to be great in transition. We want to be the ultimate modern hockey team.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, speed is never not going to play in the NHL, Sat.
No, it's true. You absolutely need speed. And the funny thing, though, is Tampa's fast, but not that fast.
Yeah.
You know, and they just get by in a different type of way. But you're right about Colorado. And if you look at the question was, especially when they got Cale Makar, does it make sense to have Cale Makar, very offensive defenseman, and Sam Girard?
Yeah.
And pay Sam Girard a lot of money? Now, Girard's injured right now, not playing. But even Bowen Byram to a lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
And look at how these guys are performing.
Look at the limited minutes Byram and Makar have played together.
They're insane.
Insane.
They're insane. I mean, it's so dominant when those guys are out there together. But you look at how they built those guys. Because the question even with Byram was, people ask the questions, like, you got Girard, you got this guy. Does that mean you got to trade Girard? You got to do that? It's like, no. Like, this is how we believe we have to play. And the thing that's impressed me a lot, because I was very critical of how they defended in their own zone, and I think they're going to be really tested against Tampa, because it's a different level, you know?
Yeah.
No matter how good you've gotten, it's a different level against Tampa. But I've been impressed by, as the postseason's gone on, they've actually matured. They've defended better. And maybe that's credit to them, because earlier on against other teams, it's kind of like the way Tampa is now, where it's like, hey, we don't have to do things
mm-hmm.
extra to win, so we don't worry about that. We just try to find a way to win this series, and we'll worry about other things later as time goes on. Maybe that was the case with Colorado. So I'm really impressed with how they defended, but it's really about how they push the pace.
Yeah.
And that's really what they're all about. Tampa, I don't think you can emulate Tampa. I think trying to say you can learn a lot from Tampa, it's true, you can in a very, like, you know, basic sense. But what are you emulating?
Yeah.
They're a chameleon.
Yeah.
They can play any style of hockey. They've hit on so many different things all through everything they've done. What have they done poorly? Nothing. They've done nothing poorly. You can quibble with some draft picks here and there that have been misses, but you look at the overall totality.
Everybody has misses in the draft.
Have so many wins that it doesn't matter.
Yep.
You look at the trades, more wins than losses.
Yep.
Signings, more wins than losses. They got back-to-back cups now out of it. They can play any type of style. You can't emulate that. A team that's going to have a three-peat potentially, something that hasn't happened in the cap era, something that hasn't happened since the heyday, like, you know, decades ago. We're talking about something different. You can't try to be that. You can aspire to that greatness one day, but it's not something you can emulate. Whereas I think with Colorado, there are certain things you can look at and say, they like you said, they were dedicated to what they wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And no matter what, they stuck with it. Even if they had playoff failures, they stuck with it. They didn't try to change it. And ultimately, now you're in a Stanley Cup final, and you could finally win that cup.
The thing, and I know Jim Rutherford talked about wanting to be able to defend better, clearing their own end a lot better. Those types of things certainly are on the mind of the Canucks management team, playing with more structure. What I would take away from Colorado is that very mindset of, we just want to play offense more than defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we aren't the cleanest in our own end, and Tampa's really going to test them on that front. I don't, like, Edmonton was just a perfect matchup for Colorado,
yeah.
right? Because Edmonton scores in transition. That's the way that they play hockey. They don't get below the hash marks and beat you up a little bit and get you running around in your own end. When St. Louis was able to do that against Colorado, it exposed some of their flaws. And I think Tampa's going to be able to do that in this series a little bit. But
Edmonton wasn't able to generate any of that sustained zone time.
I love the idea of, you know, it's the one thing about a lot of the analytics evolution is play offense more than defense, and generally you're going to come out ahead. If you are away, the further away from your own net you are, the better it is for how you play defense. And Colorado lives that mindset, and they've built their team to play that very way. And that is something I believe the Canucks need to have more of. It's something we've seen in Bruce Boudreau teams through his career, whether it was Washington, whether it was Anaheim, and even Minnesota to a certain extent, even though they didn't have as much talent as his Washington and Anaheim teams. But that ultimately is what I would take away from Colorado, and it's not exactly easy to develop that within your organization.
It's not, but you know, I'm not trying to say the Colorado pathway is easy, but it is. It's an easier pathway than the one Tampa did.
Yeah.
Because Tampa's, you're just talking about such a high level of great players, so many great players.
Well, it's similar to Chicago.
Yeah.
In a sense, right?
It's overwhelming.
How many teams? Well, you know, people are overlooking the Chicago dynasty, and I know people in Vancouver don't love to hear that, but they won 3 cups in 5 years.
I know, and now, sordid organization, right? And yeah. I think that's the thing now. You're right. I mean, and I think that's part of the reason you know they don't come up as much now, because people just want to forget that Blackhawks team.
Yes.
But as far as comparing, you know, the players and the quality of the players and the number of those high quality players, how many of the guys did they lose after their first cup? And they still retooled and went on and won a cup in a couple of years.
Chicago, Pittsburgh, Tampa, the teams that have won multiple cups here, and LA's won multiple cups in the cap era as well. But Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Tampa, those three teams all won and all have 4 future Hall of Famers on their roster.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
Right? Chicago, Taves, Kane, Keith. Hossa was on those rosters.
Hossa's a Hall of Famer.
And he's already in.
Someone want to make the argument for Seabrook. I don't think so.
Yeah. Doesn't have the offensive numbers. Pittsburgh, Crosby, Malkin, Letang, Fleury probably gets in.
Yeah. Kessel? I mean, he's not there now. But
Kessel may have the points.
The points,
to
maybe.
To at least be a fringe Hall of Famer. And now Tampa Bay, Hedman, Stamkos, Kucherov, if he keeps playing at a high level for a few more years, is probably getting in. And Vasilevsky, for me, like if he retired after this final, he's already in the Hall of Fame. So, yeah, you can't really, you're right that you can't really emulate.
Like, how do you get 5 Hall of Famers on your roster?
Right.
I mean, Vancouver was insane, and they had, what, 3?
Yeah.
If you say the Sedins
and Luongo. They didn't have a Hall of Fame defense.
And none of those guys have made it into the Hall of Fame yet.
No.
You know what I mean? But, you know, I don't think that's something you can emulate. But if you dedicate yourself, okay, we want to be fast, and we're getting players that do this one trait, and we're gonna lean into it heavily.
Yeah.
And yeah, you got to find your Makar. Now, Vancouver has Quinn. He's not Makar, but you have a guy that at least approximates that one day could be in the Norris discussion, whereas Makar right now is like in a league of his own as far as what he's accomplishing. But what is Pedersen? He's that. We still need more. That's why we sit here and we talk, and we're like, even if you trade JT, maybe you have 3 of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see, like, okay, you have Quinn, you have Pedersen if he gets that to that next level too. You have Demko who's at that level potentially if he keeps going up. So that's 3 guys. Who are your other 2? Well, if JT can stay and do that, well, that's 4. Who's your 5th? Like, now you're approximating it.
Yeah.
You're getting it a little bit closer. But everything else you got to build out. And the thing I love the most about what Colorado did was they did not veer from it. And even the last couple of years where they had playoff disappointments and we questioned it, and even I was questioning a lot of things about that team now, but they stuck with it and look where they are today. Now, they may have to reload after this year with the amount of free agents they have, but they had a window that was open, you know, and it may take a couple of years. But just I look at how they drafted their defense. They traded guys like Connor Timmins. People are like, how are you trading Timmins? You need that type of guy.
Yeah.
They're like, the other trades for those other guys mean more to us.
Mm-hmm.
And look where you're at now.
And, you know, Drew Helison they've traded. They traded Justin Barron over to Montreal. You know, trading prospects to get better and win yourself a cup is always worth it. The thing about Tampa, okay, you can't emulate building superstars like that. And this is something that teams tried to emulate out of the Red Wings for so many years, but strictly player development. Sat.
Mm-hmm.
The Syracuse Crunch, I believe, are the Tampa Bay Lightning's AHL franchise. And they're just churning out guys, right? Churning them out constantly. They're always finding guys. Yanni Gourde comes up. Great. You know, they just continue to develop players at the bottom of their roster. And that's how you sustain success for a long period of time, because they're cheap. They don't cost you anything against the cap, and they fill up the roles that you don't want to overpay for in free agency, to get back to the start of our conversation. Detroit did that for so many years. Mm-hmm. You know, how many times did you hear through the Detroit dynasty, whether it was Scotty Bowman or Ken Holland after him, we want to overcook guys, right?
Yeah.
We want them to be overseasoned in the AHL before they get to the NHL. And sure, everybody saw Detroit doing this for so many years. They weren't able to mimic it and then leave it up to Steve Yzerman to build that sort of organizational culture in Tampa Bay before leaving and joining back with the Detroit Red Wings. That's something I believe the Canucks are trying to do, and they've kind of talked about it a little bit already. it's a lot easier said than done.
Well, it's funny because you look at their teams down in the minors and look at, like, you know, whether it's AHL, ECHL.
Yeah.
They had about 7-8 guys who were between the age of 27, 29.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in their 30s.
Yeah.
So what do they do? Like, they lean into, we want, yeah, you got to have some veterans or whatever, and some guys that are old enough to come in and play games for you and be filler or whatever, and you need goalie depth. So you need to have some guys that are a bit more mature to have the depth organizationally. But they're not going out and signing guys in their 30s to be AHL guys for them.
Yeah.
They're not going out, you know, and signing AHL-specific players to play roles to be a winning team and fill a bunch of spots for them. It's players they've targeted for development.
Yeah.
And players they view as one day having potential maybe to play games for them or be assets for them. And that's all they worry about building in Syracuse.
Can you have, well, I mean, look, you want to build a good AHL team. You want to have a culture in the AHL that, like, you know, promotes winning and doing the things that you need to do to win hockey games when you get down to it in the playoffs. But, you know, when the Canucks went about building the Abbotsford Canucks this year, how much of it was about getting wins? And how much of it is developing players to eventually play on your roster? And that's something they're going to have to balance over the course of the summer. It's something, again, Jim Rutherford has talked about. Mm-hmm. Abbotsford is a big part of our project here in Vancouver. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. Keep the texts coming in. We love to see them. Kevin Woodley is going to join us. Our goalie guru. We'll also take a look at some of the lines for tonight's game. All that still to come. It's hour one of Canuck Central. Canuck Central, a presentation of your local Grip Auto and Tire location. Friendly service and expert advice are waiting for you at gripauto.ca today. In on the Dunbar Lumber text line, some of our live listeners. We appreciate you as well, listening on radio, listening on your Sportsnet app, potentially even on your smart speaker. Hey, play Sportsnet 650. It's that easy. Reg, what should the Canucks take from Colorado and Tampa Bay? Ah, everything. Yes, it seems so easy. But the one thing that sticks out from the many interviews and discussions Jim Rutherford has had over the last little while, Sat. And it was on the Daily Faceoff podcast with our insider every Monday, Frank Saravalli. We don't want to emulate other teams. We're not going to try and build a team to stop Connor McDavid. We are just going to build the best team that we possibly can. Emulating others, trying to counteract others, doesn't make a lot of sense. If I'm trying to build a team just to slow down Connor McDavid, what are the odds I even meet Connor McDavid in the Stanley Cup playoffs? Or I meet Nathan MacKinnon and the Colorado Avalanche in the Stanley Cup playoffs? It's a small probability that you end up having to go down that road. Your best chance at winning is just building the best team that you can possibly build and not worrying about what other teams are building around you.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you get caught up in trying to be the next Tampa Bay or trying to be the next Boston Bruins when the Canucks lost to them in 2011, which I think the Canucks, to some degree, were chasing the ghost of 2011 for a long time, that's just fraught with peril, really.
It's Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. Our goalie guru, Kevin Woodley, joins us every Wednesday. In Goal Magazine, NHL.com, and he joins us now. What's happening, Woodley?
Not much. Like everyone, probably raring to get this going and see what we got tonight. I'm excited for this one, especially. I'm kind of curious to see how it plays out. You know, clearly a goaltending advantage is pretty distinct, in my opinion, on one side. And yet, as I always say, goaltending never exists in a vacuum. There's certainly more than enough sort of team component to this that could tilt it away from the dominant goaltender. So I'm fascinated to see how it all plays out, frankly.
So even though Jared Bednar wouldn't confirm Darcy Kuemper is getting the start for Game 1, it does look as though he is going to return. He wasn't exactly playing fantastic earlier in these playoffs. Which version of Darcy Kemper are we getting for this Stanley Cup final?
Well, I got to think for them to have a chance that it's the version we had in the second half of the season, that that's what they're going to need. And that version was, you know, frankly, even despite the fact that they are overlooked as a dominant defensive team, and they have been for a couple of years now, like they defend exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite that fact, like even with the adjusted numbers, Darcy in the second half of the season has sort of played himself into the fringes or that second tier of the Vezina conversation. Like he was that good. He was that high, sort of above expected, again, accounting for the fact that that's a goalie-friendly environment. And it just hasn't been the case in the playoffs, obviously. You know, as a matter of fact, when you look at the 30 goaltenders that have gotten into a playoff game so far, well, I guess that'll be it unless we see Brian Elliott, but 30 goalies in the playoffs, and, you know, Darcy Kemper ranks 22nd in adjusted save percentage at -1.2%. Now, for everyone saying, see, I told you, start Pavel Francouz. Well, guess who's 23rd at minus almost 2%, Pavel Francouz. So the fact that they're here, despite that, about to play for a cup final, I mean, maybe it speaks a little bit to the competition and some of the issues that they dealt with along the way, but it also says something about the quality of this team and the way they defend, that they've managed to get this far without not even average goaltending, like below average goaltending from both guys. You know, when you take a look at, you know, like game two of the Western Conference Final, where they hold McDavid and Draisaitl and the rest of the Edmonton Oilers to zero high percentage chances and one mid percentage chance. Like that's just crazy defending. So they're a team that's built to sort of win without needing elite goaltending. And yet out of those two, the fact Kemper's been better on a whole in the playoffs might surprise some people, but also the fact that his ceiling is higher. And we saw that in the regular season. It just says to me that unless you know something,
mm-hmm.
Jared Bednar knows something about his health and his, you know, that it's going to affect him negatively. If it is indeed a vision issue, it's got to be Darcy Kemper. And add in the fact that Francouz is the one who's actually used to coming off the bench. And even more so, that tells me it's got to be Darcy Kemper starting this series.
Well, and I mean, I got a couple of things that I want to get to here. The first one being, the whole idea of being coy the way Bednar was, does that show, is that a sign of anything outside of just being coy? Is it a sign of, you know, we're just not as super confident in our guy? Or is it just, do you think, you know, gamesmanship, we're not going to say because we can?
Well, I think it's just gamesmanship. And frankly, as much as, you know, I will join those who mock coaches used to name a starter when it's one of 82 in a regular season, I fully understand it here. Like, I fully understand it here. You're talking about goalies with different tendencies, different strengths, different weaknesses. Hell, the glove's on a different side for these two.
Mm.
Like, when it comes to pre-scout and preparation, there's a real difference between Darcy Kemper and Pavel Francouz. And so whether that makes a huge difference in terms of what the Lightning are trying to do against them or not, how much they lean on a pre-scout to try and, you know, create specific chances, for example, on a power play that might, you know, go away from the strength of one guy but play into the strength of the other. Like I don't know. Whether that's a 1 or 2% advantage or even more than that, I can't say. But if it's any of it, like if there's any advantage to keeping that a secret as long as you can, then why wouldn't you? And these are two very different goalies. I mean, 1 6'5" and 1 6', you know, the way they catch, the way they move on the ice, the likelihood they're going to end up on their knees, like all of these things are very different from one guy to the other. And so if you can keep Tampa Bay guessing in terms of how much attention they pay to a pre-scout, how locked in they are on their pre-scout and the tendencies, or just even force the shooters to have two guys in mind, like, to me, why not? Whether that's a huge advantage or a tiny advantage, it's the Stanley Cup final. Every inch could end up counting in this series, so why wouldn't you take that advantage? There's nothing in the rules that says you got to be up front, despite all the gambling that goes on around the NHL. There's nothing that says you have to be up front and informative with your decisions in goal. And so in this case, I actually buy into it potentially, maybe not having a huge effect, but all it takes is some effect, and it's worth it if you're the Avs.
What's the biggest challenge when it comes to trying to facing a team like Tampa that is so selective in the shots that they take, and then all of a sudden it's such a high-quality shot? They're not going to warm you up with, you know, trying to get shots on or whatever. How big of a challenge is that going to be for Colorado's netminders?
Well, part of the challenge is they haven't faced a lot, right? Like, it's 8 days off between series. They were probably fortunate that the Rangers didn't force a game seven, because then it would have been 11 days, which would have tied a record. I think it was it 2019 Bruins and 2003 Anaheim Ducks are the only two teams that have had a break before the Cup final as long as 11 days. And I talked to J.F. Chiguerre a little bit about what that's like, because he's had it a couple times in his career through different rounds to manage. And it's not easy. Like, it's really not easy to sort of stay sharp. That rest versus rust thing is legit. And it can take you a period or two to sort of feel good about your game. And I would argue it might take longer against the Tampa Bay Lightning, because, like you said, Seth, they don't waste them. Right, they're not throwing 99%ers into your pads from the point, hoping for a rebound. They're very purposeful in how they attack. They're going to force you to be on top of your game and not make it easy. Like, you know, like a lot of times we hear, this is one of my bigger pet peeves, a goalie that hasn't played in a while in the regular season is coming off an injury, or, you know, it's a backup that hasn't started in 2 weeks, or you know, anything along those lines, and you always hear it on broadcast and whatever. Oh, or a guy coming into a game cold. Oh, just get pucks on that. Just get pucks on that. No, man, like, that doesn't work. Like, if you're just throwing pucks on that from everywhere, all you're doing is warming that guy up. You're making his life easy, letting him find that rhythm, find that timing. And the good news for Tampa Bay is you've got two guys who need to find those elements, because for Darcy, it's going to be 14 days off with the injury, but since he's seen game action. And they're a team that's not going to warm them up. They're not going to throw a bunch of crap at the net from the point and hope something bounces in. And so that's part of the challenge for the Avs. It might be one of the only reasons I'd almost lean Francouz, just based on the time off, is because he's a guy who's going to hold the edges a little more. He's going to stay with his feet under him and up on his skates longer than Kemper tends to. Darcy will slide a little bit more left and right on his knees. Whereas Pavel at his best has got a little Saros in him. I call him Saros Light, not just because they're both small, but because he's really good at sort of holding the edge of the crease, not retreating, and just beating plays on his skates. Where he gets into trouble, to me, is on rushes, where as he retreats and has a little flow in his game, he tends to widen out. And then when he makes a push, whether it's a two-on-one push or, you know, whatever, a lateral push on an odd man rush, or a breakaway where he's got to go left to right, like, I think because he widens out, he just doesn't get as much, doesn't generate as good and powerful a push as some other goalies. And that's where you can really sort of string him out and draw him out laterally. And just, you know, you've seen a lot of goals in the playoffs where it's just a tuck in on the other side of the net if you can get around him, whereas most goalies at least have the power or leave themselves the ability to sort of push back to their post and have that covered. If nothing else along the ice, I think the combination of the way he tends to retreat and widen out and sort of a narrow butterfly, doesn't have the length and doesn't rotate back to his post. Like, that's one of the things, if he's in net, you target. But for the most part, he's good at holding his edges. And from a patient standpoint, in terms of if the Lightning starts zipping it around the zone, that would be one of the areas where I think he's stronger than Darcy Kemper. And that's going to be one of the challenges for Darcy, is sort of, you know, being able to beat plays and be set and be square against a team that, you know, is going to continuously move the puck, you know, east-west, and find those seams and create those holes. If you get caught down early against the Tampa Bay Lightning, you're usually in trouble. And this is another area for Darcy, like, because he's a big goalie at 6'5", you know, you'd think he'd be, you know, a little more foundational and a little more of a technician, and he's really not. He's a field goalie. And if you watch him tonight, like, watch, if there's a pass up into the middle of the ice and an open look, he won't set at the top of the crease. He'll keep drifting, and he'll drift out into a shot. I think not being set at times hurts him, whether it's off the initial release or even just lateral plays off of that. He's moving out. If you can pass it down to the side, even below the bottom of the circle, he's caught. and especially rebounds. Like, he has a tendency for a 6'5" goalie to get caught making saves beyond his crease a lot more often than maybe, you know, in an ideal world I would like to see. And that's one of the things you can capitalize on if you're Tampa Bay. Like, a lot of teams would just throw the garbage into his pads and try and create a rebound. Tampa's more likely to get him chasing out past the top of his crease and then find one of those seams to a guy like Kucherov down at a bad angle where that one-timer for most might be difficult, but for a guy of that skill, he's going to find the back of the net every time. And with Kemper, there's no guarantee he's even in that net by that point.
Kevin Woodley, our guest. So interesting news coming out of Anaheim. You know, John Gibson would be open to moving to a contender should that happen, maybe even a bit of a trade request there. Now, I think we all think highly of John Gibson, even though the numbers haven't quite been there the last couple of years. If I'm a contender, you know, that's a big contract to take on. 5 more years at $6.4 million on the average annual value. And Anaheim's asking for a pretty high trade price from the early reports. I mean, is John Gibson as good as the contract and the trade value suggest he is, Kevin?
Well, first off, you know, I know John's kind of refuted that.
Yeah.
I think it was with Eric Stevens with the Athletic out of Los Angeles or out of California that, you know, he kind of shot down those requests. So just think we got to keep that in mind. But second off, like, I honestly don't know that I have an answer. Like, and the fact that I can't answer definitively tells you that there's a fair amount of risk involved here, right? Like, John Gibson at his best and earlier in his career, there wouldn't have been any hesitation. I still had questions about some of the elements of the way he plays. I think there is a, you know, it's funny, we just talked about Darcy Kemper, and for a goalie his size, there's a looseness to his game. And there's always been a bit of a looseness to Gibson's game. And purposely, if, you know, when you talk to the Anaheim Ducks goaltending coach, Sudarshan Maharaj, who's, you know, highly regarded, one of the greats in the game, you know, not trying to rein him in too much, not trying to make him static or robotic at all in any of, you know, the way he moves around the crease, because the skill, the raw skill that we've seen for years, like, there's a fear of losing some of those elements. If you take away some of that flow in his game, you lose some of the dynamic parts that make John Gibson special. And yet, you know, some of those elements, the flow, the extra movement, the tendency to sort of, you know, push laterally and open himself up or push in a way, the sort of body first, limb first movement that, you know, kind of, with it, for lack of a better term, really does pull your body in opposite directions. Like, it pulls it apart. And it's one of the reasons I think he's had injury troubles earlier in his career, which again raises a concern. Like, I think there's always going to be elements of up and down and potentially inconsistency there. And yet, when the Ducks were competitive in the first half of this year, he had some stretches where he was just freaking brilliant. There were some dips too. And again, I think that inconsistency comes in the way he plays, and it's something you'd have to live with if you're an acquiring team. You have to be cognizant of that. But man, there were some moments there, some stretches, a couple weeks here, a couple weeks there, where, you know, talking to the people around the team, the goalie coach, and watching a bit of it and looking at the numbers, where he looked like that John Gibson, the guy who's capable of stealing games and in the playoffs potentially stealing a series. And that's the first time in years, you know, like 3 years, that they've been competitive enough that anybody's paid attention. And I do wonder how much of the statistical slumps that we've seen, the fact that he's under expected for the last 3 years combined, like, I wonder how much of that is just the team in front of him. And it's not just that they're loose and they don't defend well. It's all the stuff between the ears that comes with playing on a bad team that doesn't score. Like, this year, they started scoring for him and he stole games. Even when they didn't defend well, he still stole games. Years past, like, there was no chance. And I've talked to Ryan Miller about this and how hard it was. Like, they just didn't score. And as a goalie, there's no greater sort of pressure than going into games thinking, man, if I let in one, it might be one too many. And that's legitimately the mindset that the Ducks goalies had for the past couple of seasons up until this year, really, where any mistake might be one mistake too many. It's a tough way to play. There's a lot of pressure there. And so you take him out of that, like, you give him a team that can score, you give him a better team. And I just wonder, can he maintain a little more of what we saw, say, pre-All-Star break, for the most part. You know, before they started tearing it down, everything started to dip at that point. But up until then, he was pretty good, even by the adjusted metrics. And even with the inevitable ups and downs that come with his style, on the whole, he was still really good. And so I got to think that if he were behind a team where, you know, he could play with that comfort level more often, that we'd see better than we've seen. What I can answer is whether what we see is $6.4 million over the full 5 years or not. I just think there's a lot of risk there.
So you know, when teams go about acquiring goalies, like doesn't have to be specifically John Gibson, but you know, let's say the Leafs want to go out and acquire a goalie because they lose Jack Campbell, or the Oilers want to go out and acquire somebody. Mikko Koskinen's left, and you know, maybe Mike Smith is looking at retirement right now. But do teams look at, hey, these are the types of chances we give up, and they go about identifying goalies that are better at stopping those? Or do they just say, hey, this guy seems like a good goalie, let's go and get him? How much are they diving into, you know, some of the data that you talk about with ClearSight's analytics to identify goalies that maybe fit better what that team is giving up, the types of chances they give up, and goalies that fit that sort of mold?
I can't say definitively who does what, because I think in a lot of cases, Reach, those are things that teams aren't, you know, it's not something they're overly open about.
Yes.
I do know for sure that there are teams that have used things like ClearSight Analytics to sort of form those opinions just based on exactly the factors you outline. Like, hey, what is this guy? Where are his strengths and where are his weaknesses in terms of the types of chances he faces, from where on the ice, the types of plays that lead up to it? You know, is he good? Do we give up a ton off the rush? Is he good off the rush, or is he only good in end zone? Things like that. Like, for sure there are teams. I would hope that there are most of the teams at least dive into the rush versus end zone thing. And yet I can think of a bunch of examples where a team goes out and acquires a goalie who's really good at end zone, but not necessarily as good against the rush, and promptly put him into a system that has a lot of rush chances, or ask him to play differently. I mean, there's countless examples, but he's retired now. So I'll use this one. And it was one I had in the past, was, you know, Eddie Lack to Carolina, right? Like there was nothing about that made sense, especially once, you know, they asked him to start becoming a backwards flow skating goaltender. Like those are his biggest weaknesses. And so when you acquire a guy and you give him money and then you say, okay, now we want you to do this, you should probably know whether that plays to a strength or a weakness. And there's an example where it was definitely, you know, not a strength. They were asking him to basically play away from his strengths, which just, you know, none of it makes sense at that point. I see a lot of examples like that. So certainly not all of them. I mean, take a look at Ottawa and Matt Murray. Matt Murray's a guy that if I could get a look at and a feel for where he's at health-wise, and if I had any sense of trust that the health was okay, because that's been the big issue over the past year, like an inability, a big part of being a number one goalie is the ability to play, to be eligible for selection. You know, durability matters. Durability is an ability, I think, is what Mike McKenna used to say. And Matt hasn't had it this year, and that's fair criticism. But in terms of his game and where it's gotten to over the past 2 years, I still think there's a goalie there. And I think when I look at the adjusted numbers, frankly, over this past season when he was healthy, there's a goalie there that actually would be a better option than a lot of the other names that are being bandied about. And he's on a shorter ticket with only 2 years left. And I'm assuming if they're talking about buying him out in Ottawa, there might be a willingness to eat some of that salary in a trade. So, but there's a guy that when Ottawa acquired him, I know damn well that the goalie department knew it wasn't going to be a quick fix, but they were rebuilding. They thought they had time. And they said it was going to be a full year to sort of make the changes necessary in Matt Murray's game to play in the new NHL. Because Matt Murray's not stupid. He didn't forget how to play goal. But the way he played goal in Pittsburgh doesn't work anymore. Locked in low and wide in his stance, you have to be able to move in today's NHL. You cannot prematurely lock in low and wide. he was in a safe stance as soon as the puck got over the blue line. You have to be able more adaptable than that. You have to be able to play. We hear a lot about Ian Clark and his three-stance system. If nothing else, you have to be able to move from a high, narrow stance when the play's at the perimeter to the zone to conserve energy, to preserve your body, and just to be more mobile as plays continue to go east-west more and more and more. Matt didn't have any of that. And it always amazed me that in Pittsburgh they couldn't seem to figure that out when the rest of us in the goalie world were looking at it and saying, just fix this. Well, it was not going to be an easy fix. It was going to take time. Credit to Matt. He initiated it in the offseason a couple of years ago. And it's been a process where, yeah, it has taken time. Yeah, it's been slow. Injuries haven't helped. But you can see the difference. And you can see the difference in the results if you know where to look in terms of, you know, some of the adjusted metrics, particularly over this past year. And yet, Ottawa's ready to give up on him. And yet their own people, when they acquired him, knew that this was going to be a long-term project. So, you know, sometimes even when you go in with a full understanding of a goalie's strengths and weaknesses and what needs to change and you know, what that process is going to be like, it's real easy to say you understand it and you're willing to be patient. But in that case, I think they got one game into the season and the head coach threw out the plan in terms of when he was going to start. Rather than look at the fact there was still work to be done, it's like, hey, we won this one, let's win another, we throw them in. And you could see the deterioration in what they were trying to fix almost immediately. It wasn't until he had a month off late in the season that you really started to see the changes take hold in his movement patterns and the way he moved around the ice, which fueled everything else. And so that was the process. That was what was going to take time. And yet you have to have everybody on the same page or you end up where they are now, potentially looking at spending money to get rid of a guy who has basically done exactly what the previous goalie coach outlined would happen. He'd get there. It just wouldn't be immediate. And the bad taste that was left in their mouth during that process is enough that they seem willing to move on. Again, last year, injuries were an issue as well, and that's fair criticism. But everything else, frankly, was predictable, and the people involved should have known it was going to happen that way. So it's a long-winded sort of anecdote, but an example, Reach, of there are teams that do the homework, that understand what they're getting into, but even when they do, they sometimes still manage to find a way to screw it all up.
Woodley, we love it as always. We're out of time. Thanks for this.
My pleasure, guys.
There is Kevin Woodley.
I mean, terrific insight as always.
Always. I find that fascinating, looking into the numbers and mm-hmm. really identifying goalies that fit the types of chances that you give up maybe more than other teams. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. Coming up, Danny Webster is going to join us. Bruce Cassidy landing with the Vegas Golden Knights. How does that shape the Pacific Division for next year? You are listening to Canuck Central on Sportsnet 650. Hour number two of Canuck Central, and it's brought to you by Andrew Sherritt Limited, your plumbing and heating wholesaler, a proud family-owned BC company helping local business since 1892. In the hour one of the show, we talked about what the Canucks might be strategizing for free agency, the types of players they might be willing to go after, and how much money they'd be willing to spend in free agency as well. Plus, we look at Tampa Bay and Colorado and some of the things the Canucks can take, some lessons they can learn from how Tampa and Colorado have built absolute juggernauts and Tampa going for a third consecutive Stanley Cup. Kevin Woodley joined us as well. Is John Gibson worth the trade value and the contract? Look, the Canucks have the best goalie contract in the league, Sat, as we've talked about with Thatcher Demko. He's only got a few miles on him, and it's $5 million a year. I wouldn't touch John Gibson right now at that money and the potential trade cost that it would get to get him.
I think if you get him on the cheap, I can see making the bet on him.
Yeah.
You know, you take the flyer, or relatively cheap, but if they want a haul, that's tough.
Doesn't sound like Pat Verbeek is willing to negotiate on lower terms. All right, let's bring in our next guest. Danny Webster covering the Vegas Golden Knights as they made a big move hiring Bruce Cassidy to be their next head coach. Thanks for this, Danny. How are you?
Doing well, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing pretty well. Thanks for making the time today. This obviously wasn't a name that was on the Vegas Golden Knights' radar, maybe when Peter DeBoer was let go. But why were they so convicted in going after Bruce Cassidy once he became available?
Well, I think it was largely due to a couple of reasons. Number one, it was obvious that I think they zeroed in on Barry Trotz from the very beginning, and I think the way that it was a little bit stagnant when it came to the coaching market in general, Barry Trotz is going to be the first domino to fall. When that became clear that Barry Trotz is going to take a little bit, and it's still probably up in the air whether or not he'll even coach this year, whether he'll take a break and take a year off. When Bruce Cassidy became available, I think it was very clear that the Golden Knights could not miss this opportunity to get a guy that they feel could be the right guy for them. So initially, when Bruce Cassidy became available, the Golden Knights decided to pivot toward Bruce Cassidy and decided to make an aggressive offer, from what I've been told, to him. So Barry Trotz was their number one guy. There was even reports that, you know, it was a deal that was agreed upon at one point. But I think the uncertainty of Barry Trotz and the uncertainty of whether he actually wants to coach this year kind of gave the Golden Knights a chance to kind of move in a different direction, and that's how we ended up here.
Well, and one of the things that I find really interesting is, like, how much change are we going to see stylistically from how the Vegas Golden Knights are going to be playing under Cassidy and from what they did under Peter DeBoer? How much do you think is, you know, how big a factor do you think that is?
I think what the more I look at it, the more it seems like a little bit of a mix between Gerard Gallant's coaching style here mm-hmm. and Pete DeBoer. I think there is a little bit of a mixture, obviously, in how his Boston teams have played defensively over the last few years. You get that sense, but on top of having a really solid defensive structure, they also had really good goaltending as well, and they were also able to turn those defensive plays into offense at the other end, which, you know, you always hoped if you were the Golden Knights, you got that out of a Pete DeBoer system, but it just wasn't enough. I think when you look at the two between Cassidy and DeBoer, I do think that there is some similarities in how they approach the defensive stylings, but I think it's a little bit more of an aggressive defense. And I think when you play an aggressive defense and you can get set up in your own zone, in the offensive zone, that's exactly what Vegas needed down the stretch. And I think that's probably what's going to help them should they stay healthy with the group that they have.
One of the things Pete DeBoer is kind of known for is volume on offense and getting shots to the net, creating havoc in and around the net. That's the way he wanted his teams to get pucks into the net. Thinking about where the game has gone recently, Danny, it's more about being selective, looking for more quality than quantity at times. Do you think that's something Bruce Cassidy might bring to the Vegas Golden Knights?
I definitely do think that is a huge part of it. When you look at the way DeBoer's style, you know, it worked in San Jose for a lot of years, and even the first 2 years in Vegas, it worked. It was just a lot of cycling around the zone, put pucks on net from the defenseman and hope that you can get either a bounce or two or a rebound and you can pot it in. I think when you look at Cassidy and just how, you know, the Bergeron line played under him, I think that's what the Golden Knights can hope for from a potential line of Pacioretty, Eichel, and Stone. So I think they look at that and they see that there are some chances of, you know, capitalizing on offensive chances more than they had over the last couple of years. And I think the argument could be made from their standpoint that if they had gotten more realistic offensive chances to where they weren't just firing shots from the blue line and hoping things would stick, that I think that they could have probably made the playoffs. So it's going to be interesting to see how he adapts that style, and whatever roster they have going into training camp is going to be interesting to see how he makes that work.
Well, because I mean, even going back to that series against Vancouver in the bubble, I mean, Vancouver was able to push that to seven games. I mean, Thatcher Demko was incredible. But what the Canucks essentially did was just defend as well as they could. They tried to box out as much as possible. A lot of shots were going through, but the Canucks did a pretty good job of not allowing those second opportunities. And against teams that can do that effectively, that makes it hard for that Vegas team. But I look at what they were able to do to get Jack Eichel and how good he was when he got to... initially, it took him a while to get going, and he had the 14 goals in 34 games when he got to Vegas. But how much of a bigger impact could he make, and how much more can he produce in a style when he's healthy that's going to be more conducive to creating more high-quality scoring chances?
Yeah, I think ultimately that is the biggest reason, and that's going to be the biggest component to this whole situation is what can Bruce Cassidy turn Jack Eichel into. And I think the way that he looked for the better part of the second half of the season when he came back, he looked, I thought, really good. And I think there can be an excuse made that he kind of wore down toward the end. And I think that's understandable when you're coming back from neck surgery. I think that when you look at how Eichel plays and the way that the Boston teams, especially offensively, kind of open up the ice a little bit, considering who they had at their disposal, that's got to do wonders for Jack Eichel. And I think that given a year now with a full training camp, with a full off season where he can kind of get back into being in hockey shape, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what Cassidy turns Eichel into.
Danny Webster, our guest, covering the Golden Knights as they hire Bruce Cassidy as their new head coach. But still a lot of question marks around how this offseason goes for the Vegas Golden Knights, Danny. And I kind of wonder from your perspective, what's the first domino to fall here? We know they have to clear some cap space. Where's Kelly McCrimmon going first here this offseason?
Yeah, that's really the big one here, because they've got to figure out, one, how they're going to re-sign Riley Smith, if they are going to re-sign Riley Smith, and of course they've got to worry about their restricted free agents. I think there are at least two trades that they will ultimately look at going into the summer, one being Evgeny Dodonov, and they'll try and re-explore that and see where they can send him, especially when he submits a new no trade list, so they'll actually know where to send him this time. And number two, Laurent Brossoit, I think, is another name that will be easily shopped or could be put on waivers at some point, just because of the emergence of Logan Thompson. After that, you're down to a couple of names that, you know, a lot of fans would hate to give up on, particularly William Karlsson or Alec Martinez, if they have to ship one of those off. I put a poll out on Twitter when I wrote my story last week about if you had to trade one, who would it be? And the majority picked Karlsson, so I put that in there. And if you can get his $5.9 million off the books, that, along with Dodonov and Brossoit, you're looking at about $13 million cleared in space, and that gives you enough to where you can sign the likes of Nick Waugh, Nick Hague, Keegan Kolsar, Brett Howden. They have a lot of decisions to make, as you alluded to. They have a lot of tough decisions that they need to make, and especially if they're going to find a way to bring back Riley Smith, they're going to have to be really creative over the next couple of weeks.
Well, they certainly have to be, and one of the things they have to get is Robin Leonard back to his normal level. And given everything he went through this past year and how he played through injuries, you commend him, obviously, but especially with how things went with him and Peter DeBoer, how critical will it be to get him back on track, and how much more likely is it now that they've made that big switch behind the bench?
Yeah, I think that's going to be huge, and I think I've been on record saying that whoever they hired as their next head coach was going to be paramount in how Robin Leonard was going to feel going into the season, which is why when you looked at the coaching market from the get-go, the minute they fired Pete DeBoer, everyone looked to Barry Trotz, because Robin Leonard had the best year of his career, and with a Vezina finalist under Barry Trotz. So you looked at that from that standpoint and thought that could be a match that was worth exploring. I think the way that Bruce Cassidy got the effort that he did from his goalies, even going back to Tuukka Rask, and then this year with Linus Allmark and Jeremy Swayman, I think that can kind of give Robin Leonard some some pause in saying that this might actually work out. And on top of that, there's always that possibility where it's more of an even split when you look at Bruce Cassidy, and because he split Swayman and Allmark right down the middle, 41 starts apiece this season. So depending on how the goalie situation fans out, it's going to give Robin Lehner a chance to get a little bit more rest. It's going to give Robin Lehner a little bit more chance to, you know, to get some extra days to recuperate and to not tax him for much of the season. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. But I think definitely whoever was going to be the coach, no matter who it was going to be tasked with that very important distinction with Robin Lehner.
A slow start to the season had Shea Theodore in a little bit of trade rumor mill, and then he finishes the season super strong, and we see, you know, kind of the Norris candidate defenseman that we've become to expect out of Shea Theodore. Do you think it's a certainty that Shea Theodore is back with the Vegas Golden Knights next season?
I think so. I think trying to move on from Theodore at this point, when you have other defensemen that you could possibly move on from, is probably not the best way to go. He's vital to what this team wants to do. And I think especially knowing you're going to get a full off season of a presumably healthy Shea Theodore and presumably healthy Alex Pietrangelo, given what Bruce Cassidy had with Charlie McAvoy, you get two of those guys now. And I think that, I think Bruce Cassidy wants to see what that can look like when you have two puck-moving defensemen like that. And I think Shea Theodore is just too vital to this organization.
Well, Danny, we appreciate the time and the insights. Thanks for this. Should be an interesting offseason.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me.
There is Danny Webster covering the Vegas Golden Knights. Shea Theodore has been on our radar here at Canuck Central for a while, but the way he ended the season obviously did put the stake in the hearts of Canucks fans. The official stake, the nail in the coffin on the Canucks season after the Canucks just kept staying alive there through the end.
And that was a tough game, too, because like they took the lead and Vegas kind of came back.
That Shea Theodore goal just before the end of regulation was not great. But, you know, he really started to show the guy that he is again. And Vegas, you know, I think it would be, given he's on such a efficient contract, right? Yeah. $5.2 million. It's one of the better contracts in the league when Shea Theodore is going. Still a fairly young defenseman as well. You know, that's, to me, if I'm the Vegas Golden Knights, if I'm Kelly McCrimmon, that's not even an option I could look at to maybe opening up cap space with this Vegas Golden Knights roster.
I mean, he's a guy that, so what I had heard a while back was that keep an eye on Shea Theodore.
Yeah.
There could be something going on, not only with the team, but also his willingness. But kind of like Danny mentioned, over that period of time now, how much of that has been mended? Now new coaches coming in, how do they view him? Because he's such a good hockey player. But it kind of seemed like at one point, his future could very much be in question there. And we'll see ultimately what happens this offseason. But if you're bringing in Bruce Cassidy, I think what you want to do, wouldn't it, to try to figure that out? At least give it a chance to see how it goes.
Well, there's an element of Vegas where things got so sour, Sat. I think a lot of guys on that team were like, what is exactly going on here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the players that have been here and been through the wars and have helped this team get to a good spot and become a contender have now been traded away. There's just a lot there. I mean, Frank Saravalli has said it to us on a few occasions, just how rotten things have gotten with the Vegas Golden Knights. And maybe it was stemming out of Peter DeBoer and some of the issues that were going on there. But this is clearly a team that needs a shakeup and needs a bit more stability moving forward, because there's a super talented team. And the other player I would circle on the Vegas Golden Knights is Nicholas Waugh, as where does he end up? That Jack Roslovic contract in Columbus, $4 million on the average annual value. I have to feel like Nick Waugh is saying, or probably licking his chops, maybe his agent is, at wondering what an RFA contract looks like for Nick Waugh.
I mean, it could be really good. I would say, I think if you look at Roslovic's season, he had a really good year.
Yeah.
Like, I think...
More offense in Roslovic than Nick Waugh.
Yeah, Nick Waugh had a great year, though, right? For him, for the role he plays, he had, what, 39 points, 15 goals, almost 40 points.
Yep.
If you did, he had played 78 games, if you go over 82 games. But Roslovic was a bit, you know, higher point production. I think, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I do believe it was considerably more.
Yeah.
I think he was on pace for something like 60 points last season. But it's also a two-year bet. And you could also even make the case that they overpaid for Roslovic.
Mm-hmm.
But Nick
Waugh can also afford to overpay for guys.
Exactly. Whereas Vegas, I'm not sure they can. But yeah, we talk about Nick Paul around $3 million. Is there a team that looks at Nick Waugh and says, here's a three-year deal worth about $3 million that Vegas just can't give you?
Yeah. Offer sheet central, potentially, for Nick Waugh. Like, and a guy that, you know, does have more offense, does profile as a third-line center, does profile as a guy that brings size and speed to your lineup. You know, these are all things a lot of teams would love to have. And oh, by the way, that right shot center. Like, it just, he seems to tick a lot of boxes that the Canucks have kind of wanted to bring to their roster.
Yes.
So that's a name I would keep an eye on. Not necessarily for the Canucks, because I just think there's going to be a lot of teams potentially looking at Nick Waugh as a cap casualty away from the Vegas Golden Knights.
We talk about how hard it is to find right-handed defensemen. It's also very hard to find right-handed centermen, especially guys who have size. And that's what Nick Waugh has. And ultimately, he may be so good that Vegas looks at it and says, we'll find a way to carve out cap space to keep him, because it's so hard to find players like him.
Do you trade William Karlsson maybe to open up cap space to keep Nick Waugh?
Mm.
That's a tough contract to move, though, with the way Karlsson has dropped off since his 40-goal season to start with the Vegas Golden Knights. Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. So Vegas is going to be super interesting in what their next steps are. Before we get to overrated, underrated, a quick thought on the other coaching decision that came down, and that is John Tortorella ending up with the Philadelphia Flyers.
You know what? I love this move so much. I love it so much because it's so potentially combustible.
Yes.
You're talking about, like, this could blow up and be such a massive disaster that I'm here for it. And it could also work. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting here and saying it is going to be a disaster. But look at it this way. This is a team that is kind of stuck at a crossroads.
Yep.
Which way do we go? What do we do? And they don't seem convinced about rebuilding. They're going to double down on it. It's kind of like where Vancouver was when they hired Torts, but not quite as far gone with where they were, you know, peak-wise, because they have more young players on Philly's roster. But it's kind of similar to it. And then you bring him into that situation, and he's, I mean, they had Alain Vigneault, who wasn't an easy, nice guy all the time. He's prickly. Torts is going to push a lot of buttons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to shake things up, great. But it can really be combustible, and what a massive disaster it can be. Unless he's the perfect Philly guy, which it could be, right? Like, you look at the types of people Philly attracts, you know, the Broad Street Bully legacy. Mm-hmm. Here's a head coach that has a lot of that fire and brimstone to him. So maybe they get engaged in the clicks, and you see this classic Philly team just emerge and roar. I just love that. It's kind of boom or bust. That's what I love about it.
Torts, did he not, you know, earn to lose a little bit of that fiery side? Like, did he accomplish nothing in his years in Columbus where he seemed to turn a corner?
Well, I mean, he did a bit, but at the end of the day, towards the end, you saw how frustrated he was. I mean, he's not going to change who he is.
Yeah.
That passion isn't going to stop.
Yeah.
You know, and you can find ways to channel it better, but you can't really change who you are, ultimately. And if things go sideways, Torts go sideways.
Yeah.
That's what kind of happens. But you know what? But I don't even hate the move, but I love it. For how big of a disaster it could potentially be, and I love watching those things from afar.
Yeah,
it's not good when it's a team you cover, but from afar it can be fun.
I'll say, you know, from a personality perspective, the personality identity of the Philadelphia Flyers through their history matches the personality of John Tortorella.
Very much so.
And Philly, you know, we talk about Vegas, what their offseason could look like. Man, Philly's offseason could be real interesting, and there are some real interesting players on that Flyers roster as well.
Torgi texts in, is Torts overrated or underrated?
Ah, it's a good way to kick off our next segment. We'll do it before the show is out. Overrated or underrated? It's coming up on Canuck Central.